The Health and Human Service Policy Committee will now come to order. Good morning, everyone. We do have a House file before us, but before we start with the House file, we are going to be hearing from the department on the proposed budget, and I'm wondering if someone from the department that's not going to be able to be here would like to make some statements. Jane, do you have to leave? Okay, well, we received some information that you had a conflict.
Madam Chair, I will be doing the primary presenting, but we'll start with the program area that needs to be in the Senate by now.
Okay, very good. All right. So at this point, we will have House File 2915 before us, and Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. I understand that this bill is going to be needed in judiciary policy, so I'm going to make the motion that House Bill 2915 be recommended to pass, be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary Policy. Please tell us about the bill.
Madam Chair, I also have an amendment.
I will move the amendment for Representative Johnson. That is the A1 amendment to put the bill in its proper shape. And all those in favor of adopting the A1 amendment to the bill, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 2915 is the recommendations of the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council for changes in the workers' compensation law. As most of you probably know, the council was created in 1992 as a permanent council on workers' compensation. It has 12 voting members. Half represent the business community, half represent the labor community. It also has 4 legislative members and the president of the AFL-CIO and the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The council has 2 purposes. It both advises the department or the Commissioner of Labor and Industry on workers' comp matters, and then it makes recommendations, usually on a yearly basis, for changes to the workers' comp law. And this is these are the recommendations for 2004. The recommendations only go forward if a majority of the business representatives and a majority of the labor representatives agree on them. So this bill is a rather delicate compromise, and please keep that in mind as we discuss it today. With that, Madam Chair, I'd like to ask Ms. Hargarten from the department to walk through the bill with the members.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam. Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. For the record, my name is Beth Hargarten, and I'm an assistant commissioner at the Department of Labor and Industry. And Madam Chair, I can just highlight the portions of the bill that deal with health issues, if that would be your preference.
That would be fine.
Members, the first section of this bill that has some health implications is Section 2. This language confirms that any injuries or diseases resulting from a vaccine that an employee received in response to a declaration by the United States Department of Health and Human Services are considered to be arising out of and in the course of employment and therefore are compensable under the Minnesota Workers' Compensation System. This provision was also in a bill that the Advisory Council had last year and that did make it through a number of committees in the House. The second section in the bill that has health-related implications is on Section 9, which I believe is on page 11. During last year's legislative session, our agency was directed by the legislature to set up a task force to look at medical cost issues in the workers' comp system. So during the course of summer and fall, we did do that. We had a number of meetings, a lot of testimony, a lot of issues were raised regarding some rising medical costs in the workers' comp system. The task force consisted of members representing business, labor, a variety of health care providers, hospital association, pharmacy association members. Section 9 of this bill is one of the items that came about as a result of those discussions that the council has chosen to adopt. This language allows an employer or insurer to contract with and negotiate rates with a pharmacy network from which the injured employee must select a pharmacy to fill prescriptions. However, the pharmacy must be within 15 miles of the employee's home or work. The second paragraph of this section also requires pharmacy benefit managers to disclose any rebates to employers or insurers. Section 10 of the bill will allow us to, or will allow electronic submission of bills between insurers and health care providers. Under the current workers' comp law, that is not allowed, so we'd like to allow that since we are moving rapidly into the electronic age. Sections 11 and 12 are also sections that came out of discussions as a result of the Medical Cost Task Force. And these sections reflect managed care negotiations. The language allows managed care plans to negotiate fees with participating providers and makes peer review, utilization review, case management, and dispute resolution optional features of certified managed care. Section 19 of the bill is also a health-related item. That is on page 24. This is pretty much just a housekeeping provision, but it does reference a list that the commissioner used to have to draw up regarding neutral positions. The list, which is referred to in this section, does not exist, and therefore, and the statute that it references no longer exists, so we just like to eliminate that outdated language. The final section of this bill that has health-related implications is Section 20, also begins on page 24. And this language authorizes the department to use expedited rulemaking to update and amend our treatment parameters. Parameters must reflect evidence-based medical practice and be developed in consultation with the Medical Services Review Board. This expedited process would only be allowed after the Medical Services Review Board has had the opportunity to review and recommend the parameters. And just for a point of reference, the Medical Services Review Board is an advisory board to the agency that contains membership reflecting business, labor, physicians, chiropractors, physical therapists, and hospital association member and a nurse member. Madam Chair, those are the health-related provisions in the bill.
Are there any questions, members, for Ms. Hargarten? Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 13 is the section dealing with 15 miles for a pharmacy. We've had a discussion, actually, about that very issue, but, Representative Johnson, unless you're prepared to build new pharmacies in a lot of places in Minnesota, I don't know how this can work, because there's many places in Minnesota where there simply aren't pharmacies.
Ms. Hargarten.
Madam Chair, Representative, the point of this language is to require an employee to go to pharmacies that are in the network. If the pharmacy that is covered under a network is not located within 15 miles of either the employee's home or the employee's place of work, then the employee can go to any pharmacy they want. And that pharmacy may be 20 miles out of the way. The point of the 15-mile limitation is to make sure that we're not requiring injured workers to go to a pharmacy that may be 30 miles away when they may have another pharmacy that's closer to them.
Representative.
Well, Madam Chair, I understand. I hear your intent, but that's not what it says. What it says is an employee is not required to obtain outpatient medications at a designated pharmacy unless it is located within 15 miles. And I know because we tried to put some in the, what we did, we put some modification language to make it work, because I don't think this works, as I said, unless you're willing to build pharmacies in a lot of places in Minnesota.
Ms. Hargarten.
Madam Chair, I think the key, and perhaps I'm misunderstanding what you're saying, but I think the key words in this are designated pharmacy. They're not going to be required by their workers' compensation insurance carrier to go to a pharmacy, a designated pharmacy, unless that pharmacy is close to them. If the designated pharmacy that the workers' compensation insurance company wants that employee to go to is 20 miles away from their house or 25 miles away from their house, the employee is not going to be required under the work comp law to go to that pharmacy. They'll be able to go to any other pharmacy and still get reimbursement from the insurance company. They'll still have their prescriptions covered under workers' compensation insurance, but they won't have to go to the designated pharmacy that the insurance company wants them to go to. There's still the requirement, though, that the insurance company must pay for prescriptions.
Representative Bradley.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Let me just ask then, if if there isn't one within 15 miles, because there isn't even a pharmacy within 15 miles. Now, it sounds like what it does is it opens up for the person to go wherever they choose to, which could mean that it costs you more because they may choose to go to some place that would cost you more than a designated. It could be, for example, that the designated one was 20 miles away and one that's not designated is 30 miles away, but it's their buddy or it's their brother or something like that. I mean, there seems to be a consequence to this that I'm not sure is understood.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's the way it is right now under Minnesota Workers' Comp. You do not have to go to a designated pharmacy. You can go to any pharmacy of your choosing and get reimbursed. So actually, this is kind of limiting those situations that I think you're talking about.
Representative Radley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if I've understood, and that's the other thing I wanted to clarify, this only applies in the places cases of workers' compensation. I assume that. And then I have another question. I guess I sort of see what you're saying. You're moving at least part way anyway, and I understand that you're in a different world in many ways. On the next section that talks about reporting, we've had discussions about this, but there have been a lot of concerns about exposing contractual relationships and potentially costing us more if the privacy of negotiated contracts get exposed. And that could have a counter effect to you as far as saving money is concerned if people aren't able to get the best possible deal because these contracts get exposed by this language.
Ms. Hartgarten.
Madam Chair and Representative, we did encounter quite a lot of discussion during the task force about the privacy of the contracts, and that's why we're trying to just limit it to the rebate amount or certain discount amounts. We heard from a number of individuals during the conversations at the task force that said that this aspect is pretty fuzzy, and they felt that it was only fair that when people are making negotiations for rates that they know everything that's going on behind the scenes in terms of rebates. Doesn't open their full contract, doesn't allow full disclosure of everything that's in the contract, but we're trying to get at the rebate aspects.
Okay, Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Garten, could you explain for me just a little bit Section 14 of this bill?
Ms. Hartgarten.
Section 14. Madam Chair, Representative, this section of the bill deals with excluding certain individuals that have religious beliefs that are contrary to purchasing social insurance programs. We've had a number of discussions for over 3 years, in particular regarding the Amish community. We received a complaint as an agency a number of years ago regarding an employer who did not have workers' comp insurance. We investigated that complaint and found that indeed they did not have workers' comp insurance. But it was an Amish employer, and they are claiming that it is a violation of their religion to purchase workers' comp insurance. They are opposed to social insurance programs. So they are challenging us on our ability to penalize and require that they must purchase workers' comp insurance for their employees. This has had years of discussion at the council. We've had a lot of discussion and debate about this. This language that you see in the bill would allow certain religious groups to not have to purchase workers' comp for their employees. But there's a number of hoops in Section 14 that they have to jump through before they get that exemption. We modeled this language off of Wisconsin. They have nearly identical language. There are a couple of states throughout the United States that have a similar exemption for the Amish. It's not designated as Amish. It's designated as religious sects that have been around for a number of years. But the realities of it is usually the only groups that end up being covered under the language are Amish and Mennonite groups.
Okay. And Madam Chair.
Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then I have another question, and that is could you tell me the percent of the percent of or the number of people people that are now receiving less workers' compensation than they did in 1994. Can you tell me that? Is the amount of use of the system going up? It's my understanding it's going down. And I would like for you to give me that, what is the percentage rate of the reduction?
Ms. Hargarten.
Madam Chair, Representative, off the top of my head, I don't know the percentage rate of the reduction. There's a couple of ways that you can answer that question. I do know that claims, the number of claims that are being filed under workers' comp is declining. That is going down. But if what you're looking for is dollar amounts that are being paid out, is the total wage loss benefits that are being paid out to employees going down, that would be something that I could check with our research people to see. Part of the problem with that is that people's wages are increasing over time. So if you're just looking at an aggregate, how much wage loss benefits were paid out in 1994 compared to how much wage loss benefits are paid out in 2004? Just giving you that number might kind of not tell you the whole story, because people's wages have increased over time, so therefore their wage loss benefits have increased over time. Perhaps the best way to answer that question is how many people actually filed a claim for wage loss benefits in 1994 compared to now, and I can certainly follow up on that and get you that information.
Okay, and Madam Chair?
Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To counteract what you said just a little bit, but wages have gone up, that is correct, for the working people,
mm-hmm.
but by the same token, so has the cost of products.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think that's about a wash. I don't know the statistics, to be quite frank with you, but it seems to me that as wages go higher and costs of corporations go higher, prices go higher. One last question, and that is, why is the number of the percent of usage, why is that declining, as you had indicated? What's the reason for that?
Ms. Hargarten.
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't think you can really pinpoint one particular thing that influences why claims are declining. It could be that recently there are less people in the workforce since we've kind of had a little bit of a recession period. It could be that employers are getting safer. I hope that's a major contributing factor, is that employers in the state are getting safer and therefore there's less injuries. It's very difficult to pinpoint exactly why it is claims may be declining.
Members, I think it's important to note that this bill is a result of the work of a council that has been working with both labor and business to try to come to some agreement as to how we should change some of the things in the work comp system. I don't know if, Representative Johnson, you want to comment on that, but how long this is work has been going on.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you. The work in this bill has been going on for at least 2 years, because a lot of the provisions in here were in the bill that we passed last year off the House but didn't survive the Senate. And one thing to keep in mind, I mentioned this is a very delicate compromise. There are certainly provisions in here that one side or the other maybe doesn't like all that much, but there are also provisions in here that same side wants very badly. And so if we take out a portion or add in a portion, it all falls apart, and that's the delicacy that I talk of here. But certainly a lot of work has gone into this.
Thank you for sharing that. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Hargarten, a couple areas on the bill that you've testified on. First, what we're now talking about, the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council. Would you refresh my memory, and for the record, tell me what the makeup, what is the extent of the advisory authority of that council?
Ms. Hargarten.
Madam Chair, Representative, that council is set up by the legislature. It's a statutorily mandated group. It is made up of equal representatives of business and labor, and the chairs are the president of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, which under statute doesn't say Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, but it says the largest business organization in the state. And the labor chair is the representative of the largest labor organization in the state, which is the Minnesota AFL-CIO. They are the two leaders of the council. There are also non-voting legislative liaisons or representatives two Senate members, two House members, one from the minority and one from the majority on each side. In order for the council to agree on something and have it be put in a bill, there has to be a majority vote on each side of the table. So four of the six labor members have to vote in favor of a proposal, and four of six business members have to vote in favor of a proposal. The meetings are four or five times a year, held at the Department of Labor and Industry, and the Commissioner of Labor and Industry oversees the board. He is not a voting member, though.
Madam Chair.
Senator Smith.
Ms. Hargarden and or the author, I heard, I think, the author's testimony that, or maybe yours, in order for their work to be, quote, put into a bill, they must pass it. The council is advisory. The legislature has not given up its right to review their work and amend it as we see fit. Isn't that correct?
Ms. Hargarden.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that is correct.
Madam Chair.
Representative Smith.
Ms. Hargarden, specifically, and maybe my last question, specifically with regard to Section 2, beginning on page 3. The bill proposes various immunities relative to the language beginning on line 36. And your testimony, I believe, was that activity reference there becomes compensable under the workers' compensation statute. Is that a workers' exclusive remedy?
Ms. Hargarden.
Madam Chair, Representative, are you talking about the line 36 that begins an injury or disease resulting from a vaccine?
Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, yes.
Ms. Hargarden.
Madam Chair, Representative, this proposal came to the council from the Minnesota Nurses Association. And the desire to have this in the bill is to make it perfectly clear that if any nurse ends up contracting any sort of illness or disease as a result of the principally that smallpox vaccines is pretty much what we were talking about. They want to make perfectly clear that any of those ill effects that the nurse suffers will indeed be covered by workers' compensation insurance. I think that there's case law and current language in the statute that they certainly would have a good argument already that any ill effects that they would suffer would indeed be covered under workers' comp insurance, but this language that's put in here is devised to make it absolutely clear that it would be covered under workers' comp.
Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, Ms. Hargarden, I'm fully aware that the nurses, or at least their lobbyists, support this language. That wasn't my question. My question is that by including these immunities, what is the effect of their rights when an injury occurs? Is their exclusive remedy that under workers' compensation, and has other remedies been precluded here?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question. This language would have no effect, I believe, for the nurses in terms of their exclusive remedy. Their exclusive remedy, yes, would be workers' compensation. I think even if this language wasn't in the bill, their exclusive remedy against the employer would be workers' compensation. In order for them to proceed against their employer in a manner other than workers' compensation, they would have to prove an intentional act on the employer's behalf that where the employer desired or intended to injure the employee.
Madam Chair, I don't have any other questions. This is a health, our purview is the health effects of this bill. I would suggest that I think you're wrong, and I think that this language will preclude any remedy other than workers' compensation, and I would recommend that the author seek this bill passing through the Civil Law Committee to review this portion. Thank you.
Representative Abler.
Madam Chair, there's some testifiers I think that want to talk. I'd like to.
I understand that, Representative.
So I'll hold my questions off the testimony's done.
Any other questions of Ms. Hargarden? Seeing none, I will now take testimony. I know that Ms. Holly wants to testify. Perhaps you could come down first.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. My name is Judy Hawley. I'm a physical therapist, and I serve as the executive director of the Minnesota chapter of the American Physical Therapy Association. Our members treat a lot of injured workers. I want to briefly share our concerns with you regarding House File 2915, particularly as they relate to Sections 12 and 20 of the bill, as introduced. Section 12 deals with managed care, and Section 20 deals with the Medical Services Review Board. I strongly believe those provisions should be deleted for the bill for these reasons. The Department of Labor and Industry has been making a dedicated effort to reduce medical provider reimbursement rates by 35%. Last year, the legislature wisely stopped that effort and requested that the department convene a work comp medical cost task force made up of representatives of business, labor, and providers. Minnesota physical therapists have participated in the work of that task force. After months of meeting with the task force, they were not able to reach a consensus on medical treatment and cost issues and made no recommendations to the Work Comp Advisory Council. Our members have participated in the work of the MSRB and have regularly attended the meetings of the Work Comp Advisory Council. The work comp system is complex, yet for 70 years the purpose has been clear. That is to treat the injured workers promptly, provide for maximum rehabilitation, and return them to work in the shortest possible period of time. Those goals have well served both the employer and the employee as compared to the rest of the country, Minnesota has done exceptionally well. The highly regarded National Work Loss Data Institute gives Minnesota an A rating. It's only one of nine states to have received this rating on early return to work. Of the nine states receiving that rating, Minnesota rated the seventh lowest in terms of cost of medical services. Simply stated, our return to work policies are working and our costs are not out of line. We should be concerned about work comp costs, and medical costs are an important component. But if treatment parameters are changed and injured workers return to work later, indemnity costs will rise. Each of you know far better than I what issues are foremost in the minds of your constituents. I do not believe work comp medical costs make up the top 10 of issue concerns. Why? Dolly reports show that Minnesota work comp costs as a percentage of payroll were 44% less in 2001 as compared to a decade ago. The Minnesota system of medical treatment for injured workers is performing very well on a cost-effective basis as compared to the rest of the nation. Ask yourself the question, is the work comp medical system broken, or is it achieving the objective that we want of maximum rehabilitation and early return to work? Managed care has been an essential element of our health care delivery outside of work comp for a long time. The public verdict on managed care is less than wholehearted endorsement of the concept. Let me submit that even if the work comp system were broken, to adopt managed care as the treatment model would run afoul of the historic legislative objective of maximum rehabilitation in the shortest period of time. Do you want to change the historical legislative objectives? We think not, because it will reduce access, delay treatment, and delay return to work. Section 12 dealing with managed care should be deleted from the bill. As regards to the MSRB and Section 20 of the bill, there is merit in allowing expedited rulemaking under Minnesota Statutes 14.389, but the section does far more than that. Repealing the language that states, based on accepted medical standards for quality health care, and replacing them with the words, based on an analysis of both medical evidence and accepted standards of medical practice, may seem innocuous. They are not. They substantially reduce the level of health care that courts have determined must be provided to achieve maximum rehabilitation of the injured worker. The Section 20 provisions changing the level of medical practice should not be adopted, but the reference to expedited rulemaking could be adopted. Before anyone erroneously concludes that we are just another group of providers seeking to protect our reimbursement rates, please consider this. The Work Loss Data Institute says that Minnesota rates an A in early return to work and ranks seventh lowest of the nine states that do the best in terms of cost. But the same study states that Minnesota is only fair in accident prevention. We asked the department to place a higher priority on accident prevention. As providers, we make absolutely no money if an injury never occurs. But accident and injury prevention should be our priority. Tragically, the department bill is silent on the prevention issue. Finally, let me say that I do not blame the Work Comp Advisory Council for the contents of this bill. I have attended the meetings of the Work Comp Advisory Council, and as an interested citizen, we were not provided with a copy of the bill being discussed. I do not believe any member of the Work Comp Advisory Council had a copy of the bill at the time of the approval. Instead, they had concepts to approve. As so many of you know, when it comes to passing good legislation, the devil is in the details. As providers, we want to work with you for the best system in the country. Unfortunately, sections 12 and 20 move in the wrong direction. Thank you.
Ms. Hawley, what I hear you saying is that managed care versus fee-for-service is somehow going to delay treatment and reduce the level of care for patients. What about most of us who are under the managed care system? Obviously, that is the majority of the people are in a managed care system, and so to bring this into the standards where the rest of us are is really the debate here. Are you saying that under a managed care system, the quality of care is going to be different?
Madam Chair, I am saying that in the work comp system, there is a focus and a priority on getting those injured patients into treatment very early. And so the staffing is such to allow that. If we went to a managed care product, we wouldn't be able to have the staffing that we have right now. We wouldn't have the level of expertise necessarily that we have now. In a work comp system, when an injured worker calls for treatment, we make sure we get them in right away. They aren't put at the end of our waiting list, which they would in a regular managed care.
So, Ms. Hawley, you're saying that those on the work comp system, if they're injured, get preferential treatment over other injured people in the managed care system. I mean, that could be concluded by that statement.
It's not only access, but it's also the timeliness, the amount of work that we have to do with an injured worker, the amount of communication, coordination, administrative things that happen with a work comp patient. But we do make sure that we see them early. We start their treatment early.
Well, I appreciate your testimony. Perhaps other members have questions. Representative Abler, do you have a question?
Are there more testifiers, Madam Chair?
We'll find out. Seeing no one with a question for Ms. Hawley, thank you for your presenting your comments.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify? I'm sorry, Representative Opetz, did you have a question?
I actually have a question, Madam Chair, for Representative Johnson.
Okay. Representative Opetz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Smith was raising the issue about the role of the council, appropriately so, and the role of the legislature. And we've had this delicate balance here at the Capitol regarding workers' compensation for a good long time. Those of us who were around for the reforms in 94, very contentious. And so we've had this balancing act looking to the council to come up with these kinds of proposals. My question for you, Representative Johnson, what will you do as the author of the bill if modifications are made to your bill that are obviously would be contrary to the balance struck by the council? You know, sort of a house of cards, and you pull one thing out here and then the thing can kind of fall apart.
Representative Johnson.
Representative Opetz, thank you for the question. I would table the bill. We certainly can't move forward with the bill without pieces of it in unless it goes back through the process again. And I'm not on the advisory council. I am carrying the bill for them. So it's my bill in name, but in substance, if we want to honor the process that I think has worked fairly well in the last few years, we need to keep what's in here. If the legislature decides that something needs to come out, that is our role. There's no question about that. But I just would not move forward with the bill at that point. Thank you.
And Representative Johnson, that seems to have been the issue the last, is it two sessions? Or I mean, isn't it? It seems as though just one entity can keep the bill from moving forward. So it's, you know, the chances seem to be reduced as far as percentages go with someone just raising an amendment or a question.
That's correct.
Here we are again. Representative Opetz?
No, I wanted to just thank Representative Johnson for clarifying that, because that oftentimes is where we end up. If we start to tinker, then everyone wants to tinker, and then the support that we have from both labor and business gets tenuous at best, and then although, as Representative Smith points out, we have every right to do in the end what we'd like to do, but oftentimes that would mean nothing gets done because
is
gone. So thank you.
I'm sorry, Representative Opetz. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify to this bill in the audience? If so, please come forward. I will note that I see no one that wishes to testify. Representative Abler, you have a
thank
comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have some comments, and then I have an amendment I'd like to offer just so we can discuss it to the strike section. I'd like to point out that the work comp system is already heavily managed, especially in what's called passive care, which is the world of therapy and chiropractic and physical medicine. There is a great deal of, they're limited to 3 months already. The fees were reduced 15% a number of years ago, and they've been relatively flat since then. There was an effort on the part of, I don't know which entity, to reduce provider fees by 35%, which is, I think, veiled in this section 12. There is no problem. If you want to have care past 3 months, it's in the hands of the insurance company to award that care or not. And they're not always open to award that. If you're severely injured with an injury to your spine, I would suggest you don't do it in the work comp system, because you're going to not get the care you might get if you had another kind of insurance. It's already very heavily managed, and many costs have been extracted out of the system already. And so to suggest that, especially in paragraph B of section 12, that they could reduce rates further, they're not going to raise rates, to reduce rates further would be not a good idea. I'd like to point out that the balance that's established is between business and labor only, and the providers don't have a seat at the table, those who are called upon to serve the individuals who are hurt. And if we're indeed trying to serve the injured parties at the best possible way, we do want to make sure the providers at least get their par rate. The current rates that are paid on workers' comp are currently about the rate of Blue Cross in the normal health plans. It's not retail. Blue Cross reduces by about a third on their usual and customary, as does the workers' comp system. They're established by a fee schedule, which has been widely disseminated and acted on, established in a section that's referenced in the bill. So there's not a problem with fees, Madam Chair. And when these managed care agreements will be brought forward with the reduction of fees of 5 to 10 to 20 to 35%, the providers will be given the choice to take it or leave it. And they're not like negotiated at arm's length. If Blue Cross brings forward a managed, I'm just, Blue Cross is one example. There's any plan, Aetna could bring forward a product. There's no criticism of any plans here. They're just doing what they're allowed to do. So if a company brought forward a managed plan, you could choose to opt in or not as being in the provider group. If you opted out, then if the company that was served by that group wanted to have work comp services provided, they could not get compensated at your office because you hadn't opted in. And so there's great pressure on providers to opt into these very bad plans, merely to have the access to the patient base that would provide, especially if it's a large employer in their town. So it's not exactly a free deal that you can go back and forth on. It's not without a big hammer on the part of the carrier to encourage a local provider, especially in a small town, to opt into this thing, should it be Albert Lea with some of the big plants down there, et cetera, where there's a big single employer. So I would hope that members look at this very carefully. And I don't know that the author is aware of that, but this is not without controversy, not without problem. My second concern, and so the delicate balance certainly is between work and labor, but they should also, I think, if this bill would die because this provision came out, they should go back and think about that too. Do they really want to harm rural access and harm rural providers that are barely hanging on anyway? We've heard a lot about rural providers and hospitals and the challenges they enjoy or that they suffer. My second concern is in section 20, actually in the same context. And maybe Representative Bradley can help me out with this. This just came out lately, so haven't had a chance to ask a lot of people what this means. We struggle with best practices all along, and we can barely find a way to describe how to do it. What this does, it incorporates some version of best practices in page 24, section 20. And in a different way. And I don't know if they understand what they're getting into here and what they're really acting on. I've struggled the whole session, even taking heat for getting government-run standards, when I'm just trying to get suggestions about how to do things better and do them the very best way. I don't know that the insurance company and the employer are in a position to establish best practices in association with the entities that they're going to change this over to. And I'm afraid of what it might come down to. They'll deny based upon some set of standards that's not even known to a certain community of providers. And so I caution the committee to be careful what you ask for, you might get it. And so this bill isn't ready to go forward. If it's all or nothing, the committee should say nothing, because these two sections in particular need to go back and be worked on. And I don't think the business community would intend to run this down, hurt the injured workers by virtue of standards that are not widely agreed upon. I know the laborer doesn't want to do that to providers to help them not be able to serve. And so I'm uncomfortable with both these sections. And we can discuss it perhaps. And I did not make a motion yet, but if I were going to make an amendment, it would be to strike paragraph B of Article 12 and section 20. So perhaps we can discuss that, Madam Chair.
Are you moving that amendment, Representative Abler?
I'd ask Representative Bradley if he'd yield, if he'd read Article 20 and offer his thoughts on it.
Representative Bradley.
I'm sorry, Representative Abler. What's your question?
Representative Abler.
Have you read Article 20? And do you see it as a best practice effort? And I applaud the idea.
I'm fine with Section 20.
Are you moving an amendment, Representative Abler, at this point?
Madam Chair, I'll move to strike Section 12, paragraph B.
Okay, Representative Abler moves to strike Section 20.
Section 12.
Section 12 and Section 20, and we will.
No, Madam Chair, the motion is just Section 12, paragraph B.
Section 12, paragraph B, is the amendment before us. And Representative Abler, I think the discussion here is about—is this about the fee for service versus managed care?
No, Madam Chair, it's about the managed care. To the chair's advice, to the chair, managed care already is an option in workers' comp. The option exists. They can have a PPO plan, about half and half. Some are fee-for-service, some are managed already. This doesn't create any new allowance for management. It allows a new level for reimbursement under management. So, Madam Chair, when we have an injured person come in our office, we have to call the employer and see if we're on their panel or not. About half of them are open panels where you can go anywhere you want, and about half are managed. And if they're managed, then we have to turn them away for their work comp coverage. They have to go elsewhere to someone who's listed on their list. That's what managed is about. And then, in any case, the fee-for-service is not without restriction. They're already managed even under fee-for-service within parameters that are defined in the system, and also a fee schedule.
I would just caution members that this has been a delicate balance already. I think we should ask Ms. Hartgarten, in regard to the fees that are being potentially could be changed or have been agreed to, I think the question is, first of all, if there is a change in the fee structure or fee schedule, is there going to be, are providers going to be paid less than other patients, treatments for other, I mean, in comparison to the other folks that are receiving treatment, is the reimbursement going to be less?
Ms. Hartgarten. Madam Chair, members, First of all, I highly doubt it would be less. Workers' compensation in this state pays higher than any other reimbursement system that's out there. We pay higher than commercial insurance. We pay higher than most traditional managed care plans. We pay higher than Medicare. And in regard to Medicare, to kind of just give you a gauge, currently we pay approximately 204% of what Medicare pays in the Minnesota workers' compensation system. Exactly how much providers will be reimbursed if we allow the negotiation of rates is very difficult to determine because that's up to them in terms of what they will negotiate. But considering how high we are in workers' comp compared to other systems, I just, you know, my personal opinion would be I'd find it surprising that they would negotiate so far down. And the flip side of it, and I think Representative Abler even touched on it in some of his comments, was that if negotiation of rates is allowed, we anticipate the volume of participation would increase in managed care. Therefore, physicians, health care providers, physical therapists, anybody that's providing health care services in the workers' comp system would have more clients, more patients coming to see them. We've seen managed care has been in the workers' comp law for a number of years, and we've seen a steady decline in how many plans are certified by the state. And we believe one of the reasons why is because they're not allowed to negotiate rates.
Madam Chair.
Representative Abler.
The witness is incorrect in her statement about the 204%. That is categorically not true. And I don't know where she got her data from. I'd like to see what they're working off of if they believe that to be true, because there's an honest misunderstanding if they believe it to be true, because at least in the world I live in, that is categorically untrue. The rates that we get reimbursed on workers' comp are below what Blue Cross pays us. They're below, way below what auto pays us. They're more on par with Medicare, close to 100% of Medicare, not anything approaching 200%, Madam Chair. That is, and if that's the premise this is going forward, and what they brought forward to their committee as a reason to pass this, then they need to at least disaggregate the data and look at it by provider group and see what they're really talking about. There may be an outlier group that has a provide their reimbursement rate much higher to get the 204% if the whole aggregate is 204%. But I will assert to you, Madam Chair, in the world I understand that I live in, that I get reimbursement checks from, we get under 100% of what we consider to be normal.
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to provide the committee with the data. The 204% is principally physicians, but I will be happy to provide all committee members with some of the data on which we're basing some of the discussions that we've had for the last 6 months.
And we would appreciate that. Any further questions? Representative Dempsey. I'm sorry. Wait a minute, Representative Dempsey. I have two more ahead of you. Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have to say I respect Representative Abler's opinion when it comes to medical issues, because that's an area that I don't tend to know much about. But I also served for a number of years on the Work Comp Advisory Council, and I know what that's all about. And so I would hate to see us do anything here this morning that would delay passage of, I think, pretty important legislation. Since it failed last year, I think that we have an obligation this year to carry it forward. So I would oppose this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Nornes. Representative Otremba.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question was piqued by something Representative Abler said, and so I'm wondering, do rates vary from different parts of the state in what workman's comp pays?
Ms. Hartgarten.
Madam Chair, Representative, the workers' compensation system has a what we call a fee schedule, and it's a maximum schedule. Providers are allowed to charge the insurance company up to that amount. During the course of the discussions that we had over the summer and fall, we did see some data that came before the task force that had widely varying costs associated with the identical procedure, even within the Twin City area. There is possibly some rural versus urban distinctions, but that's not in terms of the reimbursements, it's in terms of what they charge, because everybody in the state, regardless of where they're located, is allowed up to a certain amount under the fee schedule.
Representative Otremba.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We talked a little bit about managed care and providers. What kind of percentage of access do we have in rural versus metro as far as providers that are available and are in the workers' comp system.
Ms. Hargarden.
Madam Chair, Representative, excuse me. We, in order to be certified under Minnesota workers' compensation as a certified managed care plan, you have to meet a number of criteria. The rules that the agency has an awful lot of requirements. Some of those requirements include having reasonable access in outstate areas to providers. They have to show us in certain counties where there will be providers. They have to tell us if they don't have providers in those counties. That's for certified plans. One of the problems that we're seeing is that there are non-certified plans out there. So there are people that are representing, or organizations that are representing themselves as certified managed care. They're not certified by the state, so therefore they haven't met all of those requirements. And when they sign up an employer, the employer tells the employee, you have to go to Dr. Adams, which would be true if the plan was certified, because they've met all of those requirements, including making sure that there's reasonable access to a variety of providers. Non-certified plans, the employee won't know a difference between certified and non-certified. They don't have the time nor the energy or the inclination to try to research that. So if an organization is certified by the state, there's a number of things regarding access and variety that they do have to meet. Obviously, in some outstate areas, it's a little bit more difficult to meet some of those requirements, but they do need to make every effort to have providers within a certain amount of area.
Madam Chair. Representative Otremba.
And so how does this bill help those particular problems?
Madam Chair, Representative, in the managed care area, I think it helps a couple of ways. One, I think participation will increase in certified managed care if people are allowed to negotiate rates. I also think that unbundling of services that we talk about, where the plan doesn't necessarily have to have every single component of it, is helpful, because there are insurance companies that may already offer some of those services. And so as an injured worker, you may be getting these services from the managed care plan. You may also be getting the services from the insurance company, and sometimes they may not jive. They may conflict. And so it puts the injured worker in kind of a difficult situation where they're saying, I don't know who to go to. I don't know what I'm supposed to follow. I think those sorts of situations would decline if we had this language passed.
And just another question.
Representative Otremba.
What kind of assurance do we have that this will actually happen? Many times we have assumptions that this will happen, but do we have any kind of assurance that this actually will happen with providers and insurance companies?
Ms. Hargarden.
Madam Chair, Representative, obviously nothing's 100% guaranteed. One of the things that we do at the agency, and also that we do through with the help of this MSRB, or the Medical Services Review Board, is our part of our requirement is to monitor what's going on in the system. That's why some of these proposals came forward in the first place. We've been monitoring the system, and we see that medical costs, for the first time in history in workers' comp, we're paying more in medical costs than we're paying in wage loss benefits. And workers' comp has been around since 1913. We continuously monitor what's happening. We continuously have customer assistance people that are available for injured workers, insurers, or employers to call us to let us know what is going on in the system. We are utilizing our boards and panels, which are made up of a variety of individuals that are involved in the workers' compensation system. They also help us monitor what's going on in the system. I can't provide you 100% guarantee on anything. I wish I could. But we certainly do everything that we can to make sure that we're monitoring what's going on.
Madam Chair, I guess, you know, a big concern is there are fewer providers in our rural areas. Many times they have the insurance, the company that they're working for has a specific provider that they have to go to, and then maybe that provider isn't part of the workers' comp system, and so then there's another additional 60 miles of travel, and so that's the kind of assurance I also need to know about, because
Madam Chair.
Ms. Hardgarden.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think that if we make some of the changes that we're talking about in the managed care area, we will see greater participation of certified managed care. Certified managed care has more safeguards in it than uncertified managed care. And I think that you're seeing situations of uncertified managed care where the employer is saying to the employee, you have to go here, which they don't have to do under uncertified managed care. And they don't have outlets under uncertified managed care the way they do under certified managed care.
Representative Abler?
I think in the interest of time, and my amendment is a good amendment, but I don't think it's appropriate for today. The committee doesn't have adequate information. I need to talk to Ms. Hangarter about her data and provide whatever group the data that I know to be true and the data she thinks to be true. So I think that taking more committee time on this particular motion would be inappropriate for today. And so if I may withdraw my motion, I would like to do that. And if she would agree to talk to me about this in my office at some convenient time about this in Section 20, I would be most grateful.
Well, Representative Abler, he withdraws his motion, first of all, but Representative Abler, is it your intent to offer the motion on the floor then? I mean, this is the place to discuss it, and perhaps you aren't able to answer that, but I'm asking you at this point.
Madam Chair, I don't know. I'll do my research, and I'll do my best to strike good balance of the interest of all the people of the state.
We have Representative Dempsey. Did you have a question since the amendment has been withdrawn?
Well, I think it applies,
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, in regard to the issue. And if I could, Ms. Hargarden, in the bill and under section 12, what we're getting at, and as I read that, the content between a certified managed care plan and participating health care providers may establish fees for service articles and supplies provided to injured workers. The fees agreed, and here's the key point, the fees agreed to may be different from the maximum fees established under section 176.136. I don't know what that is, but my point is the fees agreed to may be different from the maximum. Are you saying there that they're going to drop? There will be less. Am I correct in that assumption?
Ms. Hargarden.
Madam Chair, Representative, we're saying that we, by this language, will allow people to negotiate for fee reimbursement less than the maximum that's established under the fee schedule. It cannot be more, but it certainly could be less.
Madam Chair.
Representative Dempsey.
Ms. Hargarden, why do you do that?
Representative Dempsey, that's been the discussion of the last probably half hour, and I'll let Ms. Hardgarden explain again.
Madam Chair, Representative, currently there is no provision that allows them to negotiate fees. We think that this seriously hinders the participation of certified managed care. The ability to negotiate fees will hopefully allow more managed care participation, will provide more clients or patients to providers under certified managed care. Just trying to get the nutshell there, version manager.
Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Soderstrom moves the minutes of the March 12th meeting. And members had a chance to look at the minutes of the March 12, 2004 meeting. All those in favor of adopting the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails, and the minutes are adopted. Are there any further questions or discussions? I don't think we've taken all the testimony.
Madam Chair.
Representative Abler.
What's the motion that we're going to be working on to move advance this bill?
The motion is to recommend this bill to be passed and referred to the Judiciary Committee. Judiciary Policy Committee.
Can I ask a question of the Chair?
Representative Abler, yes.
I spent the last month or so.
Judiciary was the motion.
I've been driving around my emergency health powers bill to every committee who would hear it, and some of the immunity issues took it to civil law. So if it's going to go to finance and judiciary, would it go to civil law first? Would that be appropriate?
That this bill go to civil law first?
It does discuss immunity, and Chair Smith had a thought about that, so I'm just asking your advice.
First of all, I don't know if civil law is meeting.
Is that what your intent is, to have it go nowhere, Representative Abler?
No, no, Madam Chair, just that I believe they would need, this is probably a high-priority bill of some people that they would convene. It wasn't intention to send it to a dead committee. Really, that the discussion immunity would be discussed in a policy way.
Representative Johnson can investigate that. Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, I don't have a great preference as to where we go. It's just I want to be able to go soon. And if we need to go to civil law, that's fine. But
Representative Johnson wants to go, and he's going to Judiciary Finance. Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, I don't really need to comment. However, we have requested it, Representative Johnson. You know that. And my comment on civil law should see this language was just my personal opinion. You can take it for what it's worth. I will discuss it with Chair Holberg, however. Madam Chair, on a different issue, I noticed in the packet, I'm just curious, there appears to be an amendment labeled H2915A1 to House File 2915.
No, Representative Smith, we adopted that amendment early on.
That's what I thought.
We did it kind of fast, so maybe.
Thank you.
Did you have a, okay. No questions on the amendment. All right. Seeing no further discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 2915 be recommended to pass, be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary Finance. All those in favor of the motion say aye. Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. Now we are ready to have a discussion on policy issues which would be raised by the proposed budget. And we have, good morning, we have the department here to lead off with a particular section. And good morning, why don't you?
Good morning, Madam Chair. Jane Hardwick from the Department of Human Services. I work in the Office of Management and Budget for the department. We actually missed our timeline to start off with a certain section, and folks have had to go over to the Senate. So we will proceed as quickly as we can to get through the department supplemental budget proposals. And in the context of that, we may have to defer, if it's acceptable to the committee, some questions for individual follow-up with members to try to meet your timeline here today. If I could start with thanking you for inviting us to present the governor's supplemental budget proposals for the Department of Human Services. But before I review the proposals, I would like to just share a very brief overview of the governor's proposals. The governor is proposing to reduce human services spending by about a net amount of $40 million in 2004-05 and a net reduction of $163 million in 2006-07. In addition, the governor is recommending that there be a transfer of $70 million from the Health Care Access Fund to the General Fund on July 1st of 2004. The majority of the reductions are a result of changes to provider payment rates under our health care programs, including hospital provider payments, continuing care provider payments, and payments for pharmaceutical drug costs. In addition to these reductions, there are some substantial investments proposed in the governor's supplemental budget. The largest of those is an increase in the appropriation for the Minnesota Sex Offender Treatment Program as a result of increase in referrals to that program. In addition, there's an investment in the HIV/AIDS program, some improvements in program integrity with respect to healthcare provider payments and eligibility determinations, disease management program for the fee-for-service population, assisting grandparents care for their grandchildren by removing some financial disincentives in the MFIT program, some improvement in access to mental health services and diabetic supplies and equipment. And before I proceed, I also want to acknowledge that putting this budget, supplemental budget, together was a challenge for this agency. We don't take the magnitude of these changes lightly as we put them forward, and we appreciate your consideration of the proposals. If I could take a moment to orient you to the materials that you've been provided. The first document is a blue document. It's a high-level tracking of all of the proposals in the human services area. The second set of documents are a cream-colored packet of more detailed information on each of the individual proposals, including some fiscal budget tracking information at a budget activity level. And one difference here from typical years is we've incorporated into these pages also some non-budget proposals where rider language is required so that you have an upfront explanation of that rider language. And then the third document is a light gray document that describes some non-budget proposals that we're moving forward in the human services area.
I will begin in the cream pages on page 1A. You'll notice that the tracking corresponds with each of the proposals on the left side, and the blue tracking is an HS number that corresponds to the page and proposal number in the cream section. The first proposal is a general fund administrative reduction of $2.3 million beginning in fiscal year 2005. It is a base reduction to the department's administrative operating budget. And I will move fairly quickly, so feel free to pause me, ask me to pause if necessary. The second proposal in the healthcare area is a proposal to improve our program integrity activities, including funding some positions in our surveillance area to improve our provider investigation capacity, and a two-year staffing in our program integrity area to improve detection, prevention, and prosecution of eligibility fraud in Minnesota care. The next proposal, HS3, outreach to address disparities, is redirecting existing funding that is currently used for Minnesota care outreach grants to establish and evaluate the effectiveness of a statewide bilingual call center. The advantage of this approach over the existing approach is that it would be statewide. It would address a couple of primary disparity issues that we have. One is for people of limited English speaking proficiency. The second is for access across the whole state for folks in rural areas. The existing program is targeted to specific areas of the state. This is budget neutral, but would just redirect that funding. The next proposal, HS4, is a change to the prescription drug program. There are three components here, and they relate predominantly to the enactment of the Medicare prescription drug changes that recently occurred. The first proposal is that applicants and enrollees in PDP use the new prescription drug program discount card and subsidy before they use the state-funded PDP program, and also rather than requiring that they be referred to the independent pharmaceutical patient assistance program, which is a current state requirement. The third component of this would be repealing the prescription drug program effective with the implementation of the new Medicare Part D pharmaceutical drug benefit on January 1, 2006. The next proposal, HS5, relates to folks that we serve in our MEDO program, the Minnesota Extended Treatment Option for people with developmental disabilities who are considered a risk to the general public and have been committed there. This proposal would provide state-funded medical assistance for the group that are in beds that are not certified as ICFMR beds. Because some of these folks are non-ICFMR beds, we are not able to get federally matched medical assistance. In the absence of that, these folks do not have any health care coverage for things that are not provided in the facility. For example, if they need hospitalization, pharmacy coverage, etc. HS6 is a proposal to expand tuberculosis treatment in the General Assistance Medical Care Program. Last session, we reduced GAMC coverage for undocumented non-immigrant citizens. There was still an exception under public health authority for people for whom we have a public health order and a determination that they are not otherwise eligible for public programs. There is currently a funding source for coverage for those folks. It does require a couple of additional steps, though, that delays approval for coverage of treatment. In this instance, we thought it was important to reinstate GAMC coverage because of the growing rate of tuberculosis among that population. It's a small fiscal proposal. HS7 is a proposal to clarify the income limits for the GAMC hospital-only program. Right now, there's actually an income floor for that program at 75% of poverty. We would remove that floor so that folks who currently meet the income standards for the more comprehensive GAMC program, but who have assets that exceed the $1,000 asset limit for that program, could qualify for the smaller hospital-only benefit set without spending their assets down. Right now, they're disqualified solely because their income is too low. HS8 is a request to restore medical assistance coverage for pregnant women to 275% of poverty and a special work expense deduction that we had in place for infants and pregnant women. Last year, this was a proposal that we actually had proposed these reductions in the governor's budget last year. We have since learned that by using SCHIP federal funding for undocumented pregnant women, that we are required to apply a maintenance of effort to our preceding MA eligibility for pregnant women. And so we're asking that we restore the coverage for this group to assure that we can continue access to our SCHIP funding. Madam Chair, HS9 is a proposal again related to pregnant women. In this particular instance, we, as I just mentioned, we cover undocumented and non-immigrant pregnant women using SCHIP funding and state funding. This SCHIP funding is not available for this group if they have other health insurance. So we are proposing that we no longer cover the group of undocumented pregnant women who have other health insurance because they have access to other coverage. And we can't get federal SCHIP match for them. HS11, HS12, and HS13 are all proposals to change or reduce loopholes for people who transfer their assets to access medical assistance coverage. The first relates to improving or increasing the authority to bring causes of action against people who receive assets or income for less than adequate compensation from someone who is receiving medical assistance. And it includes incorporating some express reference to recipients rather than just applicants in that particular proposal. It is a small fiscal impact. HS12 relates to people who are in a penalty period for having already transferred uncompensated assets and who are not eligible for medical assistance coverage of their long-term care services. Right now, that group can use their expenditures for the long-term care services for which MA is not paying because they're in a penalty period to apply toward an MA spend down. We're proposing that some of those expenses for long-term care, those above the statewide average payment, be the only component of that that can be applied to the spend down as opposed to the whole long-term care payment that they incur. HS13 is simply applying the asset transfer penalties of the GAMC program to the GAMC hospital-only program that was created last session. HS14 is a proposal to increase base level funding so that we can implement a disease management clinical care program in our medical assistance fee-for-service program for people who have chronic medical conditions so that they can better manage their disease and we can avoid hospitalizations. There's a small upfront investment in 05, and we anticipate savings in the following years. HS15 is a proposal to reinstate some aspects of coverage in the Minnesota Care Limited Benefit. Those two components are the mental health services. Currently, mental health services are covered, but only by a limited group of providers, psychiatrists. The community standard for mental health treatment for this group includes community licensed clinical psychologists, clinical social workers, marriage and family therapists, and we're proposing to add that array of providers to coverage under Minnesota Care Limited Benefit for mental health services. In addition, we're proposing that diabetic supplies and equipment be covered for that group. HS16 is a proposal to apply co-payments to Minnesota Care adults, a $3 co-payment for non-preventive office visits and a $6 co-payment for ER visits that are not an emergency. This may sound familiar to you. Last year, the legislature took some savings for this particular proposal, but the language implementing this was inadvertently dropped from the bill in the end, and so we did not have any language to implement this particular change last year. So we're proposing, again, the same change in the accompanying savings for that change. HS17 again relates to a change that we think was inadvertently made by the legislature last year. During the changes in the coverage for dental benefits, restorative dental benefits were provided for people in Minnesota Care who are caretakers over 175% of poverty, actually providing a benefit that was more expansive for the group at a higher income level than the group at the lower income level. And so we're proposing elimination of that expansion. HS18 is a proposal to reduce pharmacy payments to the average wholesale price minus 14%. This is consistent with the proposal that the governor brought forward last year. We believe that this is a better estimate of actual acquisition costs for prescription drugs. HS19 is a proposal to reduce inpatient and outpatient hospital rates under the MA and GAMC and Minnesota Care programs by 5%, and there would be a corresponding reduction in our payments to managed care plans for the same services. The proposal does exclude mental health services and Indian health services from that reduction. HS 20 is a proposal to change the date on which we pay some managed care capitation and performance withholding payments. Existing language directs us to make some payments in July through September in this area. Because there is enhanced federal match available for payments made prior to July 1st of 2004, we are proposing that these payments be paid in the time period in which they would ordinarily have been paid prior to the legislature delaying them in the past, and we would achieve some additional federal match to the general fund as a result, and the health care access fund. HS 21 is a proposal to transfer $70 million from the health care access fund to the general fund on July 1st, 2004. It would leave a balance on the health care access fund in conjunction with the other proposed changes to Minnesota Care of about $23 million at the end of fiscal year 2007. The next change, HS 22 in our continuing care area, is a proposal to increase the funding for the Minnesota Sex Offender Program as a result of increased costs that will be incurred due to the change in referral patterns for this group. In addition, there's a second component that would temporarily relieve counties of 90% of the hold order costs that they would incur for this increase in referrals from January 1st through June 30th of this year. HS 23 is a proposal to increase funding in our HIV AIDS programs. We have seen a substantial increase in the cost of serving the folks on this program, in part due to prescription drugs costs going up, also in part due to the fact that the population with better treatment are living longer, and we're not seeing the turnover on the programs. It's actually a positive benefit. In addition, the implementation of the Minnesota Care Limited Benefit has resulted in some folks moving to the HIV program because the $5,000 benefit cap in the Minnesota Care Limited Benefit Program is not adequate to cover HIV drug costs for the through the course of a year. And typically within 2 to 3 months, folks have hit their cap. Proposal on HS 25 is a proposal for a new medical assistance reimbursement system that will base it on price, quality, and a facility-specific cost. I believe that this is presented in conjunction with a report that has been provided to the legislature. HS 26 is a proposal to eliminate an automatic nursing facility cost of living adjustment that would occur in fiscal year 2006 and 2007. About, I believe, 70%, 75% of our nursing facilities currently get reimbursed under medical assistance through a program called the Alternative Payment System. That is the only provider type that we currently have in 06 and 07 that has an automatic cost of living adjustment. Given the issues with the budget deficit continuing to grow in fiscal years 2006 and 07, we determined that we should put this forward, so we start without a cost of living adjustment in 06-07 for that group. HS 27 is a proposal to eliminate a nursing home scholarship program and the per diem rate adjustment that is normally made to accompany that. HS 28 is a proposal to reduce continuing care provider rates by 1.5% for the list of providers included on that budget page. HS 29, again, addressing concerns related to the budget deficit in the 607, proposes to continue to limit growth and enrollment in the CADI and TBI waiver programs. We are seeing some substantial growth in those areas. We have a cap in place this biennium, and we're proposing a slightly higher enrollment cap in the 607. In the 607, we would limit it to 1,920 additional cases in CADI and limit it to 300 additional cases in the TBI program. Into the area of family and children's services, HS 30 proposes not that we not count up to $50 of a housing subsidy as income when determining MFIP eligibility in a case that includes a grandparent or other relative caretaker who receives federal SSI. If you're looking at that particular page, 30A, in the middle of the page, you can see that current law exempts certain cases from the budgeting of $50 housing subsidy as unearned income. In the second bullet there, a case that includes a parental caregiver who receives SSI. We are proposing that that parental caregiver definition be expanded to include relative caregivers such as grandparents to reduce and disincentive for grandparents to care for the grandchildren in these settings so that we can have stable homes for children. HS 31 is a proposal related to the MFIT program and diversionary work program as it relates to the family cap. There are two components. The first is a proposal that we count a proportional share of income received on behalf of a child to whom a family cap is applied in MFIP. And the second component is excluding folks participating in the diversionary work program from having the MFIP family cap timeline start. There's a 10-month grace period that would not apply while someone is participating in the diversionary work program. HS 32 is a proposal to limit MFIT participants to post-secondary education and training of 12 months. It would no longer be coverage up to 24 months. HS 33 is a proposal to draw down federal food stamp employment and training match for activities that are provided to diversionary work program participants through the MFIP consolidated fund activities conducted at the local level. That match that we would receive would be directed to the general fund through the end of fiscal year 2007. HS 34 is a proposal to limit payments for child care assistance programs with respect to absent care. We will still cover absent daycares. They would be absent daycare days for which a child is absent. They would be limited, however, to not exceeding 10 consecutive days and no more than 25 total days in a given year. In addition, we would not pay legal non-licensed providers for any absent daycare days. The savings from a couple of the preceding proposals would help us to make some investments in the child care area. There are two proposals here. One is the development of a contingency fund to address the needs of primarily to address the needs of people who would be served by the basic sliding fee program, who were disenrolled from that program because of the reductions in allocations made to counties last year. There are some folks who are eligible who are not being served right now, who were being served before the changes, and this would address that. In addition to allowing families who exit MFIP and did not use child care while they were on MFIP to access MFIP transition year child care coverage. Proposal HS 36 relates to the group residential housing and MSA programs and is intended to provide people who are chronically homeless with some additional options within our program in terms of where they may choose to live. There are two components to this. The first is to allow people who are in a Rule 36 who are receiving group residential housing or who would be eligible for group residential housing payments to access MSA shelter needy, which is the equivalent payment to the GRH level of payment, in alternative settings. And so it would give folks who are currently being served in Rule 36 some additional options in the community where they could live more independently. The second is a proposal to change the definition of housing with services to include the facilities or the settings that will be developed under the Governor's Long-Term Homeless Bonding Initiative and allow those facilities to qualify as GRH vendors. We anticipate that will have very little, if any, fiscal impact. And I should mention that I have a revised page for this particular proposal, and if I could have the page. We made an error in our calculations and our assumptions in the page that was with the numbers that were released with the governor's budget. So you'll be getting a refined page that shows a small cost of $46,000 in 05, $140,000 in 06, and $191,000 in 07. And that page would replace the existing page in your book, in your packet. HS 37 is a proposal that does not require any reappropriation, but rather to authorize the agency to implement a Title IV-E waiver demonstration project to determine whether providing adoption assistance at the same level as foster care payments would improve the permanency of children in long-term foster care. And this proposal just authorizes us to implement a budget-neutral demonstration project once we get authority from the federal agency. HS 38 is a proposal, again, without a fiscal impact, but rather rider language to reinstate some rider authority to dedicate revenues from adoption grant and foster care recruitment to adoption grant and foster care and adoption administrative purposes. This authority had been provided in the past and was inadvertently dropped from the appropriations article this last time. And this authority was assumed to be in place in last year's adoption assistance proposal was contingent upon this authority being in place. So that, Madam Chair, members of the committee, are the actual budget proposals. I think we had been asked also to go through the policy proposals before the committee, and we will move directly into that if that's acceptable to you.
Please do so.
Okay. So I would now refer to the light gray document, and someone will be joining me shortly to take you through the remainder of the document. I will just start with the first proposal, the Article 8 child care provisions. This would reinstate authority for people who are child care providers who are also participants in MFIP, who are directed to participate in activities that require that they have some child care, so that they could both be a child care provider in certain instances and be a recipient of child care assistance at other times. I will leave you now to the policy proposals.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Karen Gibson from the Healthcare Eligibility and Access Division of the Department. Starting with Article 7 and the section labeled as Section 2, this provision would authorize the Commissioner to establish test sites of up to 1 year to demonstrate and evaluate new approaches of integrating healthcare program business processes and points of access, including the provision of program information, outreach, and consumer assistance and support in our enrollment process. Provision labeled as Section 11 allows clients under the client option spend down to pay their spend down amount on or before the last day of the month upon implementation of Health Match. Currently, these payments must be made to the department by the 20th of the month. Moving to the second page, the provision labeled as Section 18 would allow an exemption to the GMC requirement to provide a social security number to people who have an established religious objection as described in federal Medicaid regulation. This would align GMC with other healthcare programs by allowing certain exceptions to the social security number requirement. The provision labeled as Section 19 allows the Commissioner to establish reasonable methods to calculate gross income for Minnesota Care that most accurately reflects the household's expected income. This would supersede Minnesota Care rule that currently prescribes only one method of calculation. The provision labeled as Section 20 would put the Minnesota Care Social Security number requirement into a statute and allow certain exceptions to the requirements that are described in MA law and regulation. This would align the Social Security number requirement for all Minnesota Care populations. The provision labeled as Section 22 requires all Minnesota Care applicants and enrollees to take all necessary steps to apply for other benefits as described in federal Medicaid regulations and to apply for those benefits within 30 days. Moving on to page 3, the provision labeled as Section 24 provides that the effective date of coverage for adding members of a family is the first day of the month following the month in which the new family member is reported. This change would be for Minnesota Care. The provision labeled as Section 26 would make individuals ineligible for Minnesota Care if they are entitled to Medicare but fail to apply or refuse coverage. Currently, statute only specifies for those who do not for those who refuse coverage and doesn't specify that they must apply if eligible. Moving on to Article 8, the provision labeled as Section 4. This provision would conform the asset provisions on burial funds for all families and children populations with our other populations as intended by the 2002 legislature. The provision labeled as Section 13 clarifies that cost-effective insurance paid by MA is not considered other health coverage for purposes of the Minnesota Care four-month insurance barrier, except if the insurance was retained after no longer considered cost-effective or the insurance continued after MA was closed. And that completes the non-budget policy changes requested in the eligibility area.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chase.
Next, hi, I'm Jim Chase with the Department of Human Services. On page four, you'll see an item labeled as, at the top there, competitive bidding. This is just clarifying last year in our rate reductions that they don't apply to the competitive bidded items that we have, such as oxygen and so forth. Section 7 is concerning what we call rolling eligibility. You may recall last year that we removed what was essentially a grace month in our managed care programs for people who didn't file their paperwork. We've discovered for the elderly and disabled, almost all of those people return anyway, and so it would make sense for their continuity of care to allow them to stay in the program. And so there's no cost to this if we just allow the elderly and disabled to have this rolling eligibility or grace month, if you want to call it that. The next couple of sections are referred to as provider tax changes. These are clarifications from the change that was made last year where we added the provider tax to medical assistance and then increased the rates to cover the additional tax. We're not able to do that for a few areas, and we need to clarify that we didn't intend to tax school districts for their IEP services and a few county services that would have otherwise been taxed, and we can't increase the rate for them. And those are the three policy-related items we have in healthcare purchasing.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jan Taylor, and I'm with the Healthcare Operations Division of the Department of Human Services. There are seven sections in Article 7 that deal with third-party liability provisions, and these provisions are being brought forward because of a Minnesota Supreme Court decision that was issued in March of 2002, and this changed the way that the department needs to pursue claims when clients have filed a lawsuit to recover medical expenses and other expenses related to an injury. Formerly, we used a lien on the cause of action of the individual, but we are now required to pursue an independent action in addition to the client pursuing their other causes of action. One of the sections deals with just a clarification of third-party payer to include contract benefits that are available for payment of medical expenses. Another section deals with the assignment of benefits notice requirement, and this basically is just a duplication of language that's contained in the lien statute that is no longer used for medical assistance recovery purposes. The next section it requires that the state agency be joined as a party to the action when the client has filed or initiated a lawsuit to ensure that we have proper notice and are not subject to statute of limitations that may otherwise expire. The next section deals with requiring notice of any settlement of a claim so that the department is a party to that settlement and can recover its priority claim for medical expenses related to the injury. And the final two sections deal with a limitation on costs and limitation on disbursements. Now that we are a party to the cause of action, we want to ensure that the state doesn't have additional liability for costs incurred by a defendant in the case of loss of the case and loser pays provisions. And that concludes the department's policy areas.
Thank you. Members, we certainly can ask questions of the department, but I want to just inform you that modifications are being at least looked at and will be probably proposed very soon. And so next week it's likely that we will have a bill before us that is a modification of the governor's supplemental budget proposal. Are there any questions? Or Representative Bradley, do you have a comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate what you said. Just to emphasize that My hope is that given we expect the targets tomorrow, I think tomorrow is Thursday, right? Tomorrow, that by Monday we'll be able to deliver and make available to you and to the public a start point for Health and Human Services supplemental bill. And I'm assuming that it might include, that was the reason for the members of this committee to be able to see many of the elements you see here, not necessarily all, but certainly many of them. And then we would expect to review the bill on Tuesday, to have public testimony on Wednesday, and then to act on the bill on Thursday. That's the current plan, with Fridays available is to kind of move things around if we get in a bind on anything. There's a lot to be done in a relatively short time, but that's the plan for the committee.
And Representative Bradley and committee members, to that, it would be hopeful that on Wednesday we'd hear the policy provisions of that proposal. Representative Bradley?
Yeah. Madam Chair, I have talked to Representative Huntley about this very thing. It's a little bit clumsy because, frankly, we don't have even a bill before us today. I thought, at least in the subject of disclosure, that this then was a disclosure to the members who are members only of the Policy Committee. But it was my suggestion that we proceed with the policy items that would be in this in the Finance Committee, so that we can act. If we don't do that series, we won't be able to complete our work by the deadline. The deadline for us to complete our bill is a week from Friday. So, and I think Representative Huntley was all right with that. I realize that that doesn't give as much exposure as I kind of wish, but I think, in fairness and then to meet the deadlines, it's almost the only way to process this.
If that's an agreement, Representative Bradley, that can be worked out, you can certainly have those hearings.
You'll be welcome
to share that. Any further discussion or questions in that regard? Seeing none, the committee CA has a little Gaelic blessing for you on the agenda. It wasn't just that the font was bad on the typewriter, so if you want to figure that out, I challenge you to do so. Seeing no further questions or discussion, the committee is adjourned.